6:05, good to have you this Wednesday morning.
Hump day.
Lot to do today.
Uh-oh, guess what day it is?
Hump day.
My bad. Jumped the gun on that.
I was How dare you?
I apologize. Again, we're dealing with a little weather. Slippery roads.
Yeah.
We've got chances for snow throughout much of the morning. So, again, just give yourself a little extra time. It's cold.
On top of the
It feels like 8 degrees right now, and it's going to be cold throughout much of the day. So, buy yourself a little extra time. Brew your coffee a little earlier.
Yeah. There are some school closings.
Yep.
WJR.com. Get all the school closings.
So just make sure you're giving yourself a little extra time this morning. Meanwhile, Donald Trump was on his way to Davos, and then he had to turn around.
Yeah, I had a little mechanical scare. Air Force One to turn around shortly after takeoff. The president was en route to the World Economic Forum in Davos last night when a minor electrical issue was detected. Reporters on board say the lights in the press cabin flickered out briefly before the crew decided to return to Joint Base Andrews out of an abundance of caution. The incident highlights growing concerns over the aging presidential fleet, which has been in service for nearly 40 years. This is the third high-profile mechanical issue for the administration in the last year, following similar flight delays for Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. President Trump has since boarded a backup aircraft to continue his trip. Meanwhile, that luxury Boeing 747 gifted by the Qatari ruling family last year, well, it remains in the process of being retrofitted for future presidential use. So it hasn't been, it's not ready yet.
Yeah. You never like those mechanical issues with Air Force One.
Oh, my goodness. No, thank you. That stuff scares me.
Yeah.
And good thing it was a safe landing back and they got on a different plane.
On a different plane.
And he's going to be 3 hours late to Davos for his speech.
The Trump administration, or rather the Justice Department, revealed in newly released documents that some of the members of the DOGE team, remember DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, where they only found about $175 billion in fraud?
Allegedly.
Two of those team members working at the Social Security Administration were secretly in touch with an advocacy group seeking to, quote, overturn election results in certain states. In one, signed an agreement that may have involved using Social Security data to match state voter rolls, which is obviously a no-no. That's a no. And, if you remember, one of the major issues with DOGE at the time was, well, are they accessing data that they shouldn't be? Or do they have access to data that they shouldn't have? And many people pointed to the Social Security Department as being one of those areas where they might have more information than they should. And now the Justice Department says maybe they did.
Well, if you remember during those time, people were raising these concerns and everyone in the government was like, no, you're being crazy. That's not what's happening. Don't worry about it. And then here it is that it is true that your Social Security information was compromised.
They revealed that the DOGE team member shared data on unapproved third-party servers and may have had access to private information. So, yeah, that's a no-no. And again, when you're bringing in a group of people that have no government experience, that have no framework for the laws, for the guardrails that are in place, you know, things like this can happen. And now the Justice Department say that it has.
Yeah, and again, like, there were these whistleblowers back in the time, and the agency told the Washington Post it was not aware of any compromise to this environment and remains dedicated to protecting sensitive personal data.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, did you kind of, you know, already kind of know that something like this could happen?
Could happen, sure. Of course it could.
Yeah.
Again, these people they've never worked in government.
Exactly.
You know, and
it's kind of willy-nilly.
And when you're tasked with going in to find, you know, waste, which there is an exorbitant amount of waste in our federal spending.
Give you that.
They, when you don't have the expertise, there are things that you work astray on.
Yeah.
So it raises security concerns of, like, is there something else here that happened? The Justice Department spoke to the Washington Post and said the department will not be investigating DOGE.
Okay.
The American Red Cross is warning of dangerously low blood supplies in southeast Michigan as hospitals struggle to meet daily needs for trauma patients, cancer treatments, and emergency surgeries. At Detroit Medical Center, doctors say they rely on blood products every day for patients with sickle cell, anemia, leukemia, and those undergoing bone marrow transplants, as well as trauma and obstetrics patients. The Red Cross says a single donation can save up to three lives, and blood drives are ongoing across southeast Michigan to rebuild the critical supply. You can go to redcross.org, find out where you can donate blood close to you, and understand that the blood supplies are dangerously low and they need your help.
It does seem like they're always like, we need blood. Like, we're having a blood drive. We really do need blood. Mm-hmm. Every time I've heard that recently, they're like, no, we really need blood. We really need donors to help us out here.
Yeah, good message to get out there. It's not that hard to do, and then you can help
absolutely
a lot of people. In the sports world, the Spartans are doing quite well on the West Coast. They beat the Oregon Ducks 68-52. Carson Cooper had 19 points. Cohen Carr had 15. But Kerr Teng was having some trouble defensively, and the cameras caught Tom Izzo in the huddle talking to Kerr. See if you can hear this. Jason, can you play it? Did you hear that? Kerr, you can't guard my mother. My mother. And the reporters knew about it. So then post-game, they asked Tom Izzo about this. And he goes, we're all flying back to East Lansing, and Kerr is flying to Appleton. Check USA Today tomorrow. My mom will be going at it in a nursing home gym.
Love Tom Izzo.
I know.
I think that's funny.
Love Tom Izzo.
Hilarious, man.
Michigan also got a win last night over Indiana, 86-72.
I understand they were raining threes.
Yeah, it was
a three game.
Big night from the outside.
Yes.
For the Wolverines. Also, you know, I don't know if you saw any of Donald Trump's press conference yesterday.
I did.
Yeah, it was 2 hours long. Yeah.
Marking his year in office in this second term. It was, again, a lot of the same stuff that you've heard, right? Yeah. It was a lot of the same stuff that we heard when he was in Detroit here last week. Mm-hmm. A lot of the same, you know, rally campaign style discussions. But he talked about what he views as his accomplishments in this second term.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he talked about, obviously, was tariffs and how important that has been to the economy. Well, yesterday, the Dow closed lower 871 points, or about 1.75%, in connection to some of the rhetoric that we've heard over Greenland. And these tariffs that are going to be put on EU
on
countries and
countries,
potential
yeah.
tariffs that are going to be placed on the United States.
Yeah, it was a long press conference. At the end, there were questions, and people were asking him about Greenland. What are you willing to do when it comes to Greenland? He said, you'll find out,
yep.
And so he's going to Davos with that background.
It seems like Gen Z and millennial voters who voted for Donald Trump in 2024 might be even more hardline than some of his traditional voters in his base. We'll talk about that next on JR Morning. Well, an interesting story out of Axios. A new survey is out that shows the younger voters who voted for Donald Trump in 2024 are more hardline. They are very much with the president on some of the actions that he has taken in his first year during his second term. And you know, guys, traditionally, young voters have been very unreliable, very unreliable. In most instances over the last 20 years or so, you know, they always want to motivate young voters. They always want to sign people up to vote, make sure they go and exercise that right. But again, young voters they've been interested in other things. If they get to the polls, they get to the polls. That's not the case for, you know, working class folks. It's not people of middle age. It's not people, elderly people are very motivated to vote. They get out and vote. Traditionally, younger people have it. Well, in Donald Trump's case, he did motivate young voters in 2024, and now those same young voters are sticking hard with him. Jason Mangone is the executive director of More in Common. He conducted this study and joins us this morning. Jason, it's good to have you.
Good morning, guys. Pleasure to be here. Appreciate you having me.
So what did you find? You talked to a lot of different people, 18,000 people. What did you find?
Yeah, absolutely. So the purpose of our study was, I think when you look at Donald Trump's base, often we tend to compress his entire base underneath this label of MAGA. And the truth is, only about a third of his coalition, depending on how you ask the question, thinks that being MAGA is important to them or identifies with the idea of MAGA. In truth, the president built a really, really big coalition of about 77 million voters who all voted for him for very, very different reasons. So the study grouped the president's voters into four distinct groups with distinct motivations, worldviews, beliefs, thoughts about issues.
You know, older Trump voters often talk policy. Younger Trump voters seem driven more by the culture. Why do you think the center of gravity is kind of shifting?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple things. First off, is that young people feel like they've had a raw deal here in the country. If I might, I'm going to read a quote from a young woman, age 33, who's mixed race from Massachusetts that we spoke with. She said, "Everything has gone downhill in this country, literally everything. We're more divided than ever. We can't afford basic things like groceries. The American dream is dead. Unless you're coming for money to start with, you can't even buy a home. Nothing runs efficiently anymore. No one seems to care at their jobs. Schools are a mess. Meanwhile, states are giving away money, housing, clothing, food to people who aren't even here legally." So I think part of what's going on here is that young people just don't see a pathway to a successful life, and that leaves them open to a much broader range of outcomes in their politics.
Through this report, you see that there's a concern over masculinity in this GOP, especially among younger Trump men. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that this gets a little bit to the previous question around young people being motivated by cultural issues. I think part of what's happened in this country is that a lot of Donald Trump's base doesn't fully believe in the hardest line versions of the things that he says. At the same time, they haven't signed up for sort of a progressive agenda that to them seems to dominate everything in their schools, their entertainment, their media consumption, all of the institutions that they participate in. And so I think that part of what we're seeing here is a conservative backlash. The other thing that I'd say, particularly among younger Trump voters, is that over the last 20 years or so, most of the dominant culture in the country has been more progressive than normal. And so if you're going to be a counterculture, and young people are often the vanguard of the counterculture, they need to be rebelling against the dominant culture. In an era where the dominant culture is mostly progressive, it's not terribly surprising that we're seeing an emergent young conservative counterculture.
I was watching CNN yesterday, and they cited a number of those who voted for Donald Trump in 2024. 92% of them not only are with him still, but agree with him on his handling on a number of important issues like the economy, like immigration. Does that surprise you? And are those young people still sticking by his side? Of those 8% that have left, are those young people?
Yeah, some are and some aren't. I think that these are two things that you need to hold in tension. You see dipping approval numbers for the president, and that's completely true. I don't think that everyone's completely satisfied with what he's doing. On the other hand, when you ask a question in a way, for instance, which is how do you still feel about your vote choice in 2024? According to our data, about 80-85% of his coalition is still with him. There's only a small group who expressed some regrets about their vote choice. So are Americans completely happy with the president right now? No. But when you ask them a question in a way that asks them, are they happier with the president than they would have been with the alternative? Then the answer is yes. I think it's easy to forget a year and a half since the debate that President Biden had. What happened with that very, very weird presidential election in 2024. And as much as Americans are somewhat dissatisfied with the president right now, they really don't trust in the Democratic Party either.
Jason, your research shows more openness to political violence among young Trump voters. Is that ideological or is that emotional?
Yeah, I think the best way to think about, I think a couple things there. Number one, I think in general, younger people are open to to stranger and weirder views. But the one dominant factor that we haven't discussed yet about young people is that social media has shaped a lot of their lives. Mm-hmm. And so in an era where folks are spending less time in person and a lot more time online, it's not terribly surprising to me that young people show more openness to political violence. In the immediate wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination in 2025, we released some data that cut openness to political violence by social media use. And we found that people who spend 5 to 8 hours a day online are about four times as likely to sometimes support political violence as those who spend less than 30 minutes a day on social media. In general, I think that openness to political violence isn't necessarily a red or a blue problem as much as it is a problem with the weird dark corners of the internet. And the more that those weird dark corners of the internet have purchase in our politics, the worse our politics and our common lives are going to be.
Jason Mangone with more in common. Appreciate your time and explaining what you found in this new study. Thank you.
I'm grateful, guys. Thanks so much. By the way, Tom Izzo is a national treasure.
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is. And that spans across the United States. way to leave that. No, it's true. And here's the other part, too. The social media aspect of this cannot be ignored.
Absolutely.
It cannot be ignored. I mean, you go back to the very first Congresses of the United States 250 years ago, and they were mudslinging. They were saying nasty things to each other. But you didn't have this other outlet where you go and rile everybody else up, too.
Yeah.
All of the name-calling and all of that relatively stayed inside those doors mm-hmm. until you got the press and everybody was starting to air their grievances out loud. But it was never this. It was never this.
And you can, you know, for social media, you can go into your own silo on social media and mm-hmm. just talk to people who believe like you, and as opposed to talking to others and having a discussion. I mean, my thing is, what happens to democracy
right.
when you have large numbers of young people that stop believing in compromise?
Mike Johnson trying to cool the waters down. We'll talk about it next.
Speaker Mike Johnson became the first U.S. Speaker of the House to ever address the British Parliament yesterday. And this was all in an effort to celebrate America's 250th birthday and boost this message of UK-US unity. But the backdrop is everything that's going on with Greenland. Let's ask Jonathan Savage, Fox News reporter and WJR contributor, how this speech was received. Good morning, Jonathan.
Hello. Good morning, Jamie.
So, you know, he says his goal was to calm the waters. Did that happen?
I think to a certain extent, I think that the message was certainly calm, but the backdrop was the seas were very stormy indeed. I think what some politicians were saying was it's all very well what Mike Johnson is putting across here, but the boss, President Trump, his message always appears to be slightly different in terms of calming the waters. President Trump is stirring up the waters as they see it. But Mike Johnson was well received by politicians and commentators. They just wonder how much weight his words carry.
I mean, you know, Jonathan, how did the British officials react to the Greenland references kind of specifically? Was there any kind of visible discomfort?
Well, Prime Minister Keir Starmer spoke after he met Mike mm-hmm. Johnson, and Keir Starmer agreed that both sides should lower the temperature and focus on dialogue rather than escalation, especially when it comes to trade and security, which are the two key issues here. One MP from the governing Labour Party, though, speaking anonymously, did say that the address was polite, well-mannered, and oddly detached from reality because they believe that it didn't confront what President Trump was putting across. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Mike Johnson said is that they can have the discussion amongst friends being allies about how to counter the threats of both Russia and China, but that they must be countered. If we ignore these threats, they will be at our peril. Is that how those in the UK see it? Do they think that there is a threat to Greenland?
They do. They do think that the high north Arctic security is essential for everyone in the Western Hemisphere, everyone in the NATO alliance. But their opinion is that American national security be guaranteed and the whole of NATO can be guaranteed together under the NATO umbrella by having joint military operations there, by the use of the Article 5 clause in NATO, an attack on one is an attack on all. They do, I think, privately disagree with the idea that there is an imminent threat, but they are aware that China has an economic interest in Greenland. They've attempted to exert economic influence on Greenland, and Russia, no doubt, has a military influence in Greenland, too.
What about what the president talked about when it came to the control of these islands in the Indian Ocean and how he disagreed with how the UK handled that? Any reaction to that?
Yeah, that was an enormously embarrassing moment, arguably humiliating for Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Last year, the British government agreed to hand over sovereignty of the Chagos Island to Mauritius. They said that it prevented legal action over the sovereignty of the island. But the whole issue is that there is a joint UK-US military base on the island of Diego Garcia. The UK said that they are going to pay $100 million to lease that back for at least 99 years, and the US would pay for the upkeep of the base. So the UK always said this is going to be fine. Last year, Marco Rubio and President Trump, they backed this deal. But yesterday, President Trump on social media saying the UK was giving away Diego Garcia for no reason whatsoever, calling it an act of great stupidity. So really embarrassing for Keir Starmer.
Speaking with Jonathan Savage, Fox News reporter, WJR contributor, and, you know, the speech by Johnson, as Jamie said, you know, aim to calm tensions. But, you know, hours earlier, the president threatened new tariffs on the UK. So how did the British official square that?
Yeah, I think that is what makes it really awkward. The tariffs are of a concern to the UK, especially because last year, Keir Starmer managed to get a trade deal, which he was pretty satisfied with, maybe not as good as they had before, but a lot better than had been threatened under what had been put forward by President Trump on the so-called Freedom Day last April. So the British government felt that their trade relationship with the US was going pretty well, and these tariffs are threatening to blow all that out of the water. So Mike Johnson coming yesterday saying, look, let's continue our dialogue, let's find a resolution. Obviously, British officials say yes, absolutely, but they're not entirely sure that President Trump is going to give them the resolution that they want.
You know, Donald Trump has talked a lot about the art of the deal. Is this part of the art of the deal? Is he forcing the most extreme scenario, which is the annexation of Greenland to the United States, to then bolster the U.S. presence there? I mean, there are already articles in place in NATO for U.S. operations militarily to happen.
Yeah, and the U.S. and Greenland have a deal by which the United States has the right to build as many military bases in Greenland as it wants and send as many troops there as it wants. And Denmark say, look, this is why you don't need Greenland for national security. You can do whatever you want, as far as we're concerned, as long as Denmark and Greenland decide the future of the island's sovereignty. So this is the whole question here in terms of, is President Trump just set putting out an extreme position in order to strike a deal? Because no one can quite see what that deal would be.
Jonathan Savage, Fox News reporter, WJR contributor, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The discussion clearly will continue as the president is heading to Davos right now, and he's going to have a speech discussing all of this.
Here's a new impression that I took from this conversation that continues. It feels like there's a trust issue here. It feels like the president is talking about acquiring Greenland to make it part of the United States, to make it a territory of the United States of America. Why? Do you not trust what Greenland's position is within NATO? Do you not trust that the intelligence, do you not trust that the operations that are happening there is in best interest of not only the United States, but NATO? Because again, like Jonathan just mentioned, if you have the ability to have as big of a military presence there as you'd like, what is the purpose of then taking control of that territory? It feels like a trust issue.
Well, again, this was my point I've been making all week, is the case hasn't been made to the American people about why this is all happening.
I think the case is, I mean, he's made the case of, you don't want adversaries taking a bigger role in that region.
But he has not made the case that they are doing that.
Well, they,
in my opinion,
Russia definitely has a military presence in the Arctic, and they've increased that military presence
and
there.
The proximity to Russia. I get all that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But why right now?
Well, the timing of it is they're increasing their presence there. China has now soldiers in the region. So that's the case. Whether or not that's a good case or not is up for debate. But that's what they say is the reason for it. And even Mike Johnson yesterday saying, like, if we ignore this, it's going to be a problem for us.
Where are the Chinese soldiers right now?
At these Russian bases in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. They don't have their own operations there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I just think that, you know, this is a big deal. We're all talking about it. Like, more information would be good.
Certainly.
That's all I'm saying. All right, coming up, are markets signaling caution? U.S. Treasury prices sent a message. We'll see what the answer is from Patrick Anderson at 6:49.
But first, 6:44, time for this week's S&P Global Mobility Minute with Mike Wall.
As a new year begins, the auto industry reflects a blend of both resiliency and challenges. For 2026, we continue to forecast a modest decline in global light vehicle production. Three main themes still dominate: U.S. tariff and trade policy, the scale of the mainland China auto industry, both at home and abroad, and evolving battery electric vehicle demand, particularly in Europe and North America. While China is facing some near-term demand headwinds as scrappage and new energy vehicle incentives are reduced, production is expected to be supported by continued export growth. Looking to North America, U.S. sales have generally outperformed expectations, yet demand faces inflationary pressures as automakers seek to recoup at least a portion of tariff costs. Turning to North America, S&P Global Mobility's latest light vehicle production outlook was downgraded slightly by 121,000 units for 2026 and now stands at 15 million units, relative to 15.3 million units for 2025, as automakers are expected to manage inventories and prioritize protecting margins. The U.S. light vehicle sales outlook for 2026 was increased modestly by 89,000 units and stands at 16 million units relative to 16.4 million units for 2025. I'm Mike Wall with this week's Automotive Minute from S&P Global Mobility.
And welcome back to JR Morning. Global markets are on edge this morning after President Donald Trump threatened new tariffs on several European countries just ahead of high-level meetings in Davos, adding fuel to an already tense standoff over his stated ambitions regarding Greenland. Stocks, bonds, even the U.S. dollar all slid in response. Bitcoin tumbled while investors rushed into gold, pushing it to an all-time high, a classic sign of rising uncertainty. And to help us kind of make sense of what this market reaction is telling us about the economy and what could come next, we're joined by Patrick Anderson, principal and CEO of Anderson Economic Group. Patrick, good to talk with you again.
Nice to talk with you again, what a thing for our first discussion in 2026.
Exactly. You know, when everything sells off except gold, what's the market telling us?
The market here is telling us this is a very bad idea, and I'm not going to exaggerate it, nor am I going to sugarcoat it. When you lose 2% of your stock market in one day, when gold climbs to all-time highs, when the borrowing costs that we all pay to finance our debt go up all around a single set of policies or statements by the government in power, it's a bad sign. And it's not, you know, it's not just some people that reflexively don't like Trump, or it's not just bad weather or things like that, or a little fluctuation. It's a very real sign that the United States is doing something that would be very damaging to its economy, to its position in the world, and something that people should pay attention to.
So if foreign investors own a lot of U.S. assets, could the U.S. be vulnerable as this rhetoric ramps up?
I think that question was answered over the last few days. I mean, we just lost 2% of our of all the savings and investment that people have in stock markets, 401ks, et cetera. A lot of that is held by Americans, some by others. A lot of retirement savings. It just became more costly for us to finance our debt. And meanwhile, the flight to gold, which is not a sign that people are confident in the United States, underlines all that. So you can't get a more clear sign that not political people, but other people are very worried about this turn of events in the United States and the consequences it would have for our relations with our military allies as well as our trading allies.
What made this stick out for me is, you know, when Donald Trump was introducing the reciprocal tariffs early on, the markets were reacting and they were very reactionary. They kind of got wise to how these announcements were rolling out as the tariff talks continued. They weren't as reactionary later on, but this was pretty substantial. Does this just speak to the volatility of the situation?
I think your observation is a very good one. And I know we talked about those early tariff announcements, but also we talked when candidate Donald Trump came to the Detroit Economic Club, not in 2026, but as a candidate in late 2024 and said, we're going to do tariffs. He announced that. To his credit, he was not a politician that didn't said one thing and did another, at least on tariffs. But I don't recall a discussion about, claiming that there was a right of force, which is one interpretation. I'm not going to say that's the final statement, but that's one interpretation of the president's statements about Greenland. And that is a completely different matter than pursuing a tariff policy, which American presidents have done periodically, along with others, over the last century and a half.
So when tariffs become tied to geopolitics, does that make them more destabilizing for markets?
I guess, again, that question was answered the last few days. I mean, people ignored and thought it was silly, funny, or insulting to talk about Canada as the 51st state. But nobody, even the president didn't talk about occupying it. But Greenland is part of Denmark. Greenland has a particular status. The United States has a very strong treaty with great powers that it has under treaty rights from 1951. There's really no reason that a lot of the world can see for America to talk about forcibly acquiring Greenland when it has a treaty that already allows us to have bases on Greenland and do even more than we're doing now. And that is definitely not just roiling markets, but really making our close allies question things that we don't want them to question.
All right, Patrick Anderson, Principal CEO of Anderson Economic Group. Always great to have you on. Give us your insight. Appreciate your time this morning.
Good to talk with all of you.
So I guess, all eyes are on Davos now and, listening to see what the president says and does and how it's going to affect markets today.
Yeah, he's arriving in Switzerland. He'll be stepping off Air Force One any moment. I don't expect any decision on Greenland in this trip. Feels like they're going to continue to butt heads. They're going to continue. And here's the other part. And Jamie, to your point, you mentioned it yesterday. So Mike Johnson goes to Parliament to talk about this issue to the British people. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's out here doing something completely different. He's out here talking about buying it or why we need the whole deal. And you've got Mike Johnson, who is very close to the president, very aligned with the president's agenda. And he's like, well, we're going to tamp this down. Donald Trump's out here doing something completely different.
Jonathan Savage reported that the British folks there were like, well, how do we believe you, Mike Johnson, when we hear what the president is saying? And so we'll see.
And the president said yesterday during his speech yesterday that he was going to go over here and they were going to have some type of deal that was going to make everybody happy, including NATO. Everybody's going to be happy. So we'll see.
I can understand the idea of this. I understand the national security aspects, not only for the United States, but for Europe as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Russia feels very emboldened by what has been happening over the last couple of years. They've experienced setbacks, but they've also built new relationships with North Korea. They built on their relationship with China. So maybe they feel a little bolstered, and maybe our allies and us feel that we need to take action against that. We have to push back against that somehow.
But why not bring the allies along with you?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's what I don't understand about
7 o'clock hour coming up, and next I'll tell you about that CEO of the Oxford Clinic where that little 5-year-old died. Well, she's being charged with something else. I'll tell you what next.
7 o'clock hour. Good to have you on this Wednesday morning.
Uh-oh. Guess what day it is? Pump day.
A slippery commute out there. We're going to start seeing more snow showers throughout the morning. Probably crescendoing at around 10:30 or so.
Yeah.
It's the biggest chance for snow that we'll see probably before noon. But give yourself a little extra time just in case this morning. I got an alert from our school district that buses are going to be running behind a little bit today because of the weather. Not only the road conditions, but it's very cold. It feels like 8 degrees out there.
Cold.
Yeah.
Yes. And so places like Covenant House are not having a normal capacity day. They're opening the doors to people.
So check on your loved ones, too, especially the older folks in your life. Just make sure they're all right. And give yourself a little extra time this morning. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is wheels down in Davos. He is in Switzerland, has yet to deboard Air Force One. But he had a bit of a issue this morning. It was an electrical issue on Air Force One not long after he took off from Joint Base Andrews, had to turn around and land because of a minor electrical issue. Checked everything out, and then back up in the air. Now he's in Switzerland.
The owner of a Troy Medical facility already facing murder charges is now charged with healthcare fraud. Tamala Peterson, owner of the Oxford Recovery Center, was arraigned yesterday on 9 counts of healthcare fraud and filing false claims. The state says she knowingly benefited from fraudulent billing, including charging for services not provided. The investigation began after complaints from former patients and providers. Now, Peterson was released on a $10,000 personal recognizance bond. She is also waiting a decision on whether she'll stand trial on second-degree murder charges in the death of a 5-year-old boy killed in a hyperbaric chamber explosion at the Troy Center. So she is really in trouble.
Yeah, that was just a terrible story, too. It was incredibly sad.
I can't even think about it.
I know. And we've talked about this story, and I know that's hard for Jamie. It's hard for all of us, that this boy had to lose his life because people were not taking care of business, allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you hear this, that the Justice Department told a federal judge in Maryland that DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, members use Social Security Administration information, misused it? In the court filing, it happened on Friday. The official said that representatives from the Social Security Administration told them a recent review found that in March, after a temporary restraining order by the judge blocking DOGE's access went into effect, an unnamed political advocacy group contacted two members of DOGE with a request to analyze state voter rolls. And it seems like there was some misuse here of sensitive information of Americans.
Well, one of the folks that had been looking into this on the DOJ side of things said it wasn't clear if these two DOGE team members actually share data with this advocacy group. They're not naming the advocacy group either, but they said that the email suggests that DOGE team members could have been asked to assist the advocacy group by accessing Social Security Administration data to match the voter rolls. So whether or not they actually share the data, they had the data and they were in communication with these groups.
It seems like, when there's smoke, there's fire. And the NBC News is reporting that a person sent an executed agreement to the advocacy group on March 24th. So what did they send? Probably sensitive information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does. It could be that way. Meanwhile, investors were leaving stocks and bonds. They were selling off, and we saw gold hit another
high. Gold was at top, yeah.
On the news of Greenland and the tariffs and things like that. And it just strikes me as you don't see the markets react like this to these tariff news, especially as the tariff news went on, with more tariffs and the flurry of news. They kind of got smart. They were like, well, this isn't making as big of an impact as we expected. So they kind of took things with a grain of salt. And now this was a big sell-off, 1.76%. The Dow, the Nasdaq slid almost 2.4%.
Yeah, and these European and world leaders are taking these threats to Greenland seriously. That's what they're talking about at Davos. And there's a lot of buzz after Mark Carney spoke, and he's calling this a restructuring of the world order. And he said, quote, "When the rules no longer protect you, you must protect yourself. But let's be clear-eyed about where this leads. A world of fortresses will be poorer, more fragile, and less sustainable." So if, again, like if there's not this alliance amongst countries and we all go into fortresses, his point of view is that it's not as safe.
It very well could be. You don't want to silo everybody off at a time like this.
No.
At the same time, you know, is everybody aligned? And I'm not so sure everybody's aligned.
Here's to hoping, you know, the president just landed. There's some discussion behind the scenes, not releasing in their text messages and talking about it publicly, but privately they figure this out.
Yeah. I mean, he made it seem like that's something that's going to happen from yesterday. He made it seem like, you know, when I get over there and we you know, talk, I think Denmark and NATO will be happy.
Yeah, it to me, it kind of goes back to what I said yesterday about Minneapolis. Go into a room and talk.
Mm-hmm.
No cameras, no nonsense. Go and get everybody's perspective. It's the same thing that should happen here.
Yeah.
I mean, whether or not Donald Trump created this or this administration created it, whatever, there needs to be a discussion.
Yes. Yes, there does. There absolutely does. All right, let's talk about sports briefly because this is one of my favorite sound bites of the day. Tom Izzo talking to Kerr Tang. The microphone picked him up in this game against the Oregon Ducks.
Kerr, you can't guard my mother. My mother.
Did you guys make that out?
Kerr, it's funnier the more you listen it.
You can't guard my mother.
Guard my mother.
My mother. The Spartans would beat the Oregon Ducks 68-52, but let's ask Tom Izzo about this on Friday.
I love it.
Yes.
Also, what's it like living on Mackinac Island in the winter, being a small business owner? We'll talk about that coming up. But first, 712, time for WDJR's Business Beat. Brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WDJR.
Good morning. You know what's hot in the world of startups today? People starting businesses as freelancers. That's what. The annual Freelancer Economic Impact Report was recently released by Fiverr International Limited. That's the company behind the popular freelance finder app known as Fiverr. And the report was based on data from millions of tax returns and non-employer statistics compiled by the U.S. Census Bureau. The report, among other things, estimates the size, growth, and earnings of the independent professional workforce in various top markets in the U.S., which now has an estimated 6.9 million independent professionals and nearly 4 million freelancers concentrated in the top 30 U.S. cities. And that's an annual increase of 4.3%. The report also shows independent professionals in the U.S. are estimated to generate around $320 billion in revenue, representing 1.1% of the U.S. GDP and $208 billion in just the top 30 markets. All of the changes going on today are forcing real change when it comes to business, and even more so at the startup sector level, where change has a heightened and more acute impact to those earliest of businesses. And given that one of the fastest growing segments of the startup world today is indeed freelance type businesses, it's no surprise that the report shows that freelancing has increased in every one of the U.S.'s top 30 markets last year, including Metro Detroit, which, by the way, ranks 17th in the nation with 83,000 or so freelance workers. New York leads the country with 589,000 independent workers. Second is L.A. with 429,000. Then Miami, Chicago, and Dallas round out the top five. The fastest growing markets in the U.S. for freelancer startups is Orlando, Miami, Nashville, Las Vegas, San Antonio, and Dallas. Freelancing is hot. Think about it. Either as a full-time endeavor or as a part-time side hustle. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So this week I've been scrolling Instagram, not doom scrolling, actually looking for some wholesome content, for some giggles and laughs. And I came across Kate Conlon's Instagram. She's the owner of the Mackinac Island Cookie Company.
Sold.
Well, first of all, cookies, yes.
Yes.
Had you at cookies, right?
I mean, absolutely.
Okay.
But the most recent posts by her are about her life living on Mackinac Island. I'm watching her and her daughter go on their snowmobiles to get food and go out to dinner and stuff. And I'm just so interested in this. So we're bringing Kate on right now. Hi, Kate. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
How cold is it up there?
Oh my! So it's a test this morning. Okay,
ballpark.
I have purposefully not been outside yet.
It's about 16.
Okay.
But in a couple days, we're going to get down. This weekend, we're expecting a high of 2.
Yeah.
So
balmy.
So how's that snowmobile trip in those kind of temperatures?
You know it's cold when everyone's riding around with their visors down. Most everybody on the island rides around with them up so you can see each other's faces. And so when everyone's got their face shields down, then you know it's really cold.
You know, Kate, most people know Mackinac Island in the summer, you know, bikes and fudge and tourists and all over the place. What does the island feel like when winter really sets in?
Quiet. It's very quiet. I turned my snowmobile off to pump gas the other day, and I was right on the coal dock, which is in the very middle of the Scheffler's dock and the Arnold Line dock, mm-hmm. and it was silent. I mean, there are no boats. There was one other snowmobile ahead of me getting gas, and that was it. There wasn't a sound to be heard. It's really peaceful. I enjoy just taking my snowmobile out and going for a ride or buzzing downtown. I feel like Dowd's is my social outing. So I'm at the grocery store a lot. It's a lot of my content. But it's just beautiful. I feel this way about Mackinac in the summer, though, too. It's just a different world. It's a very different world in the winter, but it's very peaceful and beautiful.
So your Mackinac Island Cookie Company isn't even a year old yet. How long have you been on the island? How long have you lived up there?
So I grew up just northeast of St. Ignace in Hessel in the Leschino Islands. And I did 2 summers. My story on Mackinac is kind of long. My family and I, well, my family, we would vacation here in the summer growing up. My parents own and operate a 101-year-old marina, so they can't go far in the season. Mm-hmm. So this was our family vacation so they could go home if they needed to. And then I did 2 summers at Grand Hotel in college. And then I started working at Mission Point in 10 years ago, in 2016. And then I moved to Grand Hotel. We moved off the island in 2020 after the hotel sold. And we just moved back 2 years ago for my husband is the general manager at the Inn at Stonecliff. And we've had a business at my parents' marina. We've had a cookie company there for 10 years last year, so 11 years. And we always talked about if we were going to do another brick and mortar, we'd love for it to be on Mackinac. So when we moved back here, it all kind of fell into place, which has been a dream.
That's so great. So what are the specialties at Mackinac Island Cookie Company? And can you get your product in the winter or just in the summer?
We do ship. We're working on a website build out right now so that you can easily ship and you don't have to talk to us if you don't want to. But we have an email address on our Facebook page and on our Instagram page. You can always message us for orders. My mom has made all these recipes up, save the peanut butter recipe, which is my great-grandmother's recipe, actually who my daughter's named after. We grew up with these recipes. And we started realizing in high school that they were special when teachers were fist fighting over them at bake sales. We were like, huh, these are just our, you know, cookies we have at home. So when we opened the location in Hessel 10 years ago, we decided that would be a great staple and it has been great. So we've got oatmeal chocolate chip, Dutch chocolate chunk, which we import chocolate from the Netherlands because that's our heritage. And then we have oatmeal raisin, snickerdoodle, peanut butter, breakfast, which is a gluten-free cookie. We've got some gluten-free options. And birthday, which is basically a cake. It's gigantic. And we've got about 5 or 6 new flavors that we're working on right now to launch for the spring. So
if you need taste testers, you let us know.
Right.
Okay, it's weird. I never seem to have a shortage of taste
testers.
Yeah.
But I'm serious. If you need taste testers, you call us.
Well, we'll get you guys some cookies.
Yeah. There you go.
Sounds good. I think we could probably do that.
I wonder, Kate, does winter give you space to be more creative or to kind of rethink how you run the business?
Yeah, I sort of stepped away in November and went, okay, I can't do any social media posts right now or bake another cookie just for 1 second. It was crazy in a great way. We loved it. But I needed a second to hang out with my kids and just sort of get motivated again. And so the holidays were great. It was a good reset. And then on January 1, we started creating our new recipes. We shipped through that whole time. We shipped through the holidays and stuff like that. But it's nice to have to recharge your batteries. Yeah. I know it seems like it would be an easier season because it's 6 or 7 months. But there's a lot that goes on the back end for a Mackinac Island business. It makes it really more like 9 or 10 months. And It's just, it's busy, busy, busy. So it's really nice to recharge your batteries in the winter and, yeah, get creative again.
I just have a couple questions about life on the island. How many kids go to that school?
Oh, my daughter is in the preschool.
Okay.
And her class is, they have a big class. I think they're at about 15.
Wow.
But, and your average, and that'll split, you know, when the kindergartners move up to first grade, that'll sort of even out. Last year they graduated 6 students, I believe, which is pretty average. The year I graduated high school in Cedarville, they had 8. 10 is okay. A big class. So
I did,
you know,
hear
around there.
Like the basketball team has to take planes to go play games against other schools.
Yeah. And other schools fly in.
That is so funny. Wow. Okay. Last question. I saw this comment under one of your stories. Someone said, okay, what if it's really cold, but there's no snow? Do you have to take your bike?
Yeah, last year was a bit of a challenge. We did not have that much snow. And so it was, the service company pulled a dray off of, you know, commercial delivery. They deliver construction goods and UPS and things like that. And the kids were hayriding back and forth from school because it was just ice. I mean, you couldn't do any.
Oh,
walk outside.
Goodness.
You were like, how am I going to, you know, where am I going to go on what? So that it does become a challenge, but
different way
say,
of life, but it seems really
it's
cool.
Very different.
And if
yeah,
you
awesome.
Want to follow along like I have been, your Instagram is Mackinac Island Cookie Co. Thank you, Kate
yeah.
Conlon. This has been fun.
Thank you guys so much.
Wow.
It's just so different than how we live here.
It's a different way of life.
You have to bundle up because you're riding a snowmobile
right.
to your next destination. I think it would be a nice, slow pace way of life, but I don't know if I could do it all the time.
All the time?
There's no Somerset. There's no TJ Maxx.
That's true.
Yeah.
Could you imagine that? If Mackinac Island had a
TJ Maxx,
why
unbelievable.
Do we live here? Oh, there's another drop.
It would awesome. It would be a good one if it was there.
Well, coming up next, we thought we'd have a little bit more fun. What makes Michigan unbeatable? And what makes us consider Florida every February? There's a dichotomy, right? We'll talk about it next, 7:35.
All right, 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. We want to hear from you. What is the best part about living in Michigan in the winter? I've got a few, but we want to hear from you, 800-859-0957. No. I think we live here.
Wear this
that
one
was
out.
A moment of weakness.
Yeah.
Jamie was very cold. It was very cold in the studio.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of wonderful things about this state in the winter. What do you guys think? What do you love about this state?
Well, I mean, I'm not a skier, but for skiers, you know, and snowboarding and those types of things, I think it's a great place. Sometimes the scenery is good, too, because a lot of these lakes and things are frozen.
You're a sightseeing guy?
When it's frozen, I don't mind looking at the frozen waters. There's some beauty in that, you know. And then you have these different festivals and stuff, ice sculptures, Plymouth ice sculpture and those kind of things. Those are nice for here.
By the way, I was talking about skiing to our friends up at Boyne one time.
Uh-huh.
And I told them when I went skiing a lot when I was younger, I would use snow blades instead of skis, which are shorter skis.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And let me tell you, they don't look very kindly on snowblading.
Oh.
They mercilessly roast
you. You're not real.
You're like, you're not a skier.
You're not right.
You're a blader.
I'm a blader.
Yeah,
blader.
Yeah.
What do you love?
Well, I like skiing. I like ice skating outside. So these rinks that have the ice outside.
Campus Martius,
I think is
in Royal Oak.
So fun.
It's on my bucket list next year.
And getting hot chocolate and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that kind of stuff.
I'm a big vibes guy in the winter.
Okay.
Like I love opening up all the windows. Opening up the curtains and blinds and stuff.
Yeah.
And when it's snowing and, you know, you've got, you know, a candle lit or something, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Snowing, skiing, sledding, all that stuff with the kids is a good time.
That's me.
Here's something else I love, and it's very underrated. You talked about the isolation on Mackinac Island at this time of year. If you go on like a trail, cross-country skiing trail or a snowboarding trail, you just stop, and you've got fresh snow and all the trees are covered in snow.
Yeah.
And it's quiet. It's just all the birds are gone, right? All the animals are hibernating, whatever it is. They're not around as much.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go into the woods, and it's just quiet and beautiful. It's special. Really cool.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, when you're doing your everyday life and it's freezing outside and the temperature hurts your face, you're kind of like, why do I live here? But then when you're enjoying it, then it's a different story.
800-859-0957. Mark's in New Baltimore. Good morning, Marky.
Hey, guys, how are we doing? What a beautiful day we have today.
It's exactly
still dark. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how can you not love Michigan? We got four seasons. We got great summers, the fantastic falls. The springs just reunite as you come through the cold winters. And winters are awesome. You got beautiful white snow. We got to have the snow. Without snow, winters are boring and there's not much going on. So the snow just makes things vibrant. It makes you excited. It makes you full of life. How can you not like four seasons of Michigan?
Mark, what kind of coffee are you drinking this morning? I need a cup of that.
For Pure Michigan?
I love you, Mark.
That was a nice commercial.
Hey, I don't drink coffee, but I'm just loving life, and I love Michigan, and we're all about Michigan.
Good
Sounds
for you.
Good.
Absolutely agree. Emily's in Washington Township. Good morning, Emily.
Hey, good morning. I'm not exactly pro-winter, but I am not. Well, you can do things in winter you can't do any other time. You can have lots of quilts, lots of hot chocolate, and call the doggy over to sit and keep you warm.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
That's a vibe right there.
Yeah, speaking of vibes.
Absolutely. So you don't want to abolish winter. You just, you like it when it gets a little warmer.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you do with winter the way you do with anything else bad. You make lemonade out of lemons.
That's there you go.
Exactly
there
right. That's the mindset. Emily, thank you. Have yourself a wonderful Wednesday. George is in Battle Creek. George, good morning.
Good morning. The best part about winter is ice fishing.
Oh, yeah. Another
I've
good
never
one.
Done that.
I have never been ice fishing either.
We have 327 lakes, I think, here in Barry County, just north of Battle Creek, and so far I've made about 100 of them. You get an auger, you drill a hole in the ice, and you put your little rod down there. And if it's really going to be cold and you're spearing pike, you can take and set up a shanty and actually have a heater in there and a radio and everything. And
tuned to WJR.
Right on. You better believe it. How do I know to talk to you then?
Yeah, exactly right.
That's right.
So what? How does that, the shanty that you mentioned, putting up the shanty, when do you put it up, when don't you?
Well, you have to make sure you can't leave it on the ice when it's going to melt in the spring. Otherwise, it falls through. You get fined by the DNR, the state, for pollution. Mine's a portable one. It's kind of like a sled, and I can take it out, and it folds open. It's plastic and fiberglass, so I can take it home every night if I want. The guys at Spear Pike have a big plywood one, maybe 8x8, so three or four guys can get in there and have a little liquid beverage and listen to the radio. And look for the pike, and they have a bigger hole. They have like a 2 or 3 foot hole cut in the ice with a chainsaw, because you get a big pike, you got to be able to get out, and a 10-inch auger won't do it.
Yeah. Have you caught a lot of fish this year?
So far, we've had about 3 days, and one early on, they weren't biting, but there was one good day when they were biting, and we can limit out at our 50.
There you go.
Okay.
Very good.
All right.
George, thank you. Appreciate it. You know, here's the other thing that I actually do like. And people think I'm crazy. I actually like to drive in the snow.
Okay. All right. Now you've done it.
I do.
Okay.
Much like I don't believe that you open all the windows and listen. I don't believe you enjoy driving
really
in the snow.
You really enjoy driving in the snow.
I do. Yes, I do. And it stems
it's
from.
It's getting hot in here.
It stems from when I was a kid. And like my mom would take us to empty parking lot.
Okay.
And we would do donuts. And we would just sit there and spin around.
Well,
and
see that. That was fun. But driving in on a freeway in the snow or on a street where other people are, you know, fishtailing and going too fast.
It doesn't bother me. Like, it doesn't I know people who like white knuckle and they get real, and the anxiety goes up.
Yeah.
I don't mind that.
Okay.
You just got to build it into your day. That's all.
That is how my dad taught me how to drive in the winter. He like took me to an empty parking lot and was like, all right, go. Now hit the brakes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would slide.
Pull the e-brake and you're just spinning around. Love it.
We did have a caller call in. She couldn't wait. She was in her car driving in this.
Yep.
And she had what I think is the best thing about winter, no yard work.
Ooh, no yard work is very good.
There's still maintenance. Well,
yeah, you still got to shovel.
You see, shoveling snow to me is worse.
It's a lot easier to shovel to me than do all the other stuff. I agreed with her 100%. Like, yeah, I don't got to get out and get the lawnmower and the weed whacker. It's 100 degrees.
You don't have to go pull dandelions or whatever.
Yeah, I get that.
That's pretty good.
I'm with her.
That's pretty good. By the way, it's not like I'm out in the woods every day taking in nature. I just enjoy it. It's a nice thing that we have.
I get it, yeah.
That you can't experience in Georgia or whatever.
The place in Muskegon, I went and did a story. You can go do the luge if you want to try luge.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
That's a no for me, dog.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Did you do it?
Yeah.
You did the luge?
Yes, regular people can go do luge in Muskegon, and they also have like a ice trail through the woods, which is neat.
Yeah, I lived in Muskegon. I didn't do that, but I lived in Muskegon
Would you?
For a year.
I don't think I could do the luge.
Probably not.
Was it fun?
Yeah.
Well, how fast did you go?
I don't know that answer. I think it's in the story.
It probably feels faster than you actually were going.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it was scary at the top.
You know, the other thing is, what's the one where they go head first?
There's a Jerry Seinfeld joke about that.
Sculling?
Instead of bobsled, it's just Bob. That's called skeleton.
Skeleton, that's it. Yeah. That's it. We'll take a break. This push to ban cell phones in schools, hoping to raise reading scores, math scores. Well, now there's been action here in the state of Michigan. We'll tell you about it next on GR Morning. You know, we've seen in recent years the slide of our public school system here in the state of Michigan, whether it's math scores, reading scores. There is no reason Michigan should be near the bottom of any list when it comes to education for our children. And one of the efforts to help bring those scores up was banning cell phones in schools. They only serve as a distraction and take away from the participation of students in schools. At least that's the thought of those who have introduced legislation to ban cell phones in schools. And somebody who has been at the forefront of this for quite some time is State Representative Mark Tisdale. It is part of our Capitol Report today, brought to you by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And Representative Tisdale joins us. Good morning. Good to have you.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So this was a vote that failed before previously in the House, but it got through this time. What changed?
Well, when it came to the floor in July, the Republicans, my side of the aisle, didn't have 56 members on the floor. And of course, to pass anything, that's the number you need. And it was an opportunity for the other side of the aisle to flex their political muscle a little bit and demonstrate their relevance, that we need them to pass good legislation. And so, you know, those things happen. It's Lansing. It was a day when politics prevailed, but this time around it passed 99-10. So we're good.
This doesn't ban all phones. It targets smartphones during instruction time. Why draw the line there?
Well, the problem with a smartphone is you can use it for so many things, and particularly with teens and tweens, school-age kids, it's the access to social media and all of the drama that can result out of that. Basic phones are allowed all day in school under the bill. A basic phone, you make a phone call, you send a text, you put it away. There's nothing else you can use it for. And in some rural areas where there are longer walks or bike rides because there's no bus system, many parents wanted to be able to keep contact. So take a basic phone with you, and parents, you can save an awful lot of money by buying your child a basic phone instead of a smartphone.
Passed by the House, what's going on in the Senate? Could this become a reality here in Michigan?
Well, actually, it's on the agenda for a vote in the Senate today.
Excellent.
We've worked very closely. Well, thank you. We've worked very closely with Senator Pohanky and her office. The senator is a chair of the Education Committee over on the Senate side. And we've worked very closely with the governor's office. Of course, she mentioned this as a priority in her 2025 State of the State address. So my guess is, she'd like to see it get through the Senate and put on her desk to be signed into law before the next State of the State and tout it as an accomplishment.
Is there a direct correlation of doing away with smartphones in schools and an improvement in reading efficiency or math efficiency?
Yes. The test scores across the board have improved when you institute these restrictions and time specific prohibitions. The other thing that's huge in this is that, again, that absence of drama. Avondale Middle School in Auburn Hills is, they're in their fourth or fifth year now of a bell to bell, from the morning bell to the afternoon bell prohibition. In their very first year, there was an 80% drop in fights, an 80% drop in disciplinary referrals and counseling referrals, a 100% drop in assaults on teachers. And you just eliminate that whole, you know, hundreds of cameras pointing around trying to capture something embarrassing and put it online to get likes or clicks. That's all gone.
You know, Representative, when this debate started, only about 9 states, I believe, had phone limits. Now it's about 36. That tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah, Lloyd, you're right. It's up to about 38 now that have some kind of statewide standard. My first draft of this bill was in 2023. And as I said in my floor speech in the House, you know, when I started shopping that around, people would say, you can't take smartphones away from kids in school. You know, today it's, hey, when is Michigan going to start taking smartphones away from kids in school? People are recognizing this is just pure common sense, and it's about time.
Are you watching the experiment in Australia and how they're doing? They're trying to ban these apps and things from teens altogether.
Well, in fact, I have House Bill 4388 that would require age verification. When you open a social media account, first thing you have to do is consent to a contract. Their terms of use agreements are contracts. Well, we don't allow minors to consent to contracts anywhere else. Why would we allow a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old to consent to an online contract? There's nothing special about that. And that gives parents authority on the front end. A parent or guardian would have to approve that and then have total access to the account. The whole design, these devices can be addictive. And the whole purpose of social media is to be an addiction, to bring the users back time and time again, and to keep them on longer and longer, and that makes them a more valuable data point to sell.
All right, well, we'll certainly watch as the Senate could make a move today on this bill. Mark Tisdale, as always, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Very, very good, and thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, certainly. You know, it's like yesterday when we talked about where Michigan falls in the country of states that, you know, support growing businesses and starting new business. Mm-hmm. You know, they're 30, according to this Wallet Hub study.
Yep.
Michigan should never be 30. Should never be 30 in anything.
No.
And the fact that our education system has dipped so low, bottom 10, it's unacceptable. So what are we doing to fix it? I applaud Mark Tisdale for at least trying something, right? And other states have these cell phone bans across the country. And so, we got to make some action here. Something needs to move forward, and we'll see how well this works.
And I don't see it as, you know, like some people see it as banning, technology. I don't see it as banning technology. I see it as reclaiming attention.
Sure.
Classroom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And
when your phone's flipped upside down, you're wondering about what's happening on that.
Oh, yeah.
Phone.
Uh-huh. And if you hear it vibrate, dopamine hit, you're just I got to check what that is. Yeah, and that's not what they need in class. We'll take a break. 8 o'clock hour is on the way. Still a lot to do. The affordability crisis still front and center. It's next on JR Moore. We're getting some snowfall here to start the 8 o'clock hour here in downtown Detroit. So take it easy today.
That wind is blowing too. I'm looking at those flags on the building across from us, and those flags are waving, buddy. They are waving, so it's chilly.
Yeah, they're moving.
Yes.
Wind chill today, going to make things significantly colder than it is. Feels like about 8 degrees out right now here in Detroit. So We should be seeing an uptick in snow really up until about 10:30. It's going to continue to ramp up until then and then maybe come down. We might get a little snow in the around the noon hour as well.
This weekend, though, just be careful. Those wind chills are going to be really bad this weekend. So really bundle up. Make sure the pets are in and just bundle up.
It's tough. It's Henry's birthday today, so he's turning
happy
four today.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Henry.
And, you know, Jake's birthday's in the summer. That's easy. Like, yeah. You can do anything. It's tough now.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what do you want to do? Go out when it's feels like eight degrees right. And build a snowman? He's like, no, I don't want to do that.
Bounce house.
Yeah, bounce house, bowling, yeah. You know, something like sure. That. So just take it easy this morning as you're you kick off your commute. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is in Davos to talk to world leaders. All of this as the Greenland thing has not gone away. And in fact, as you know, Mike Johnson addresses the British Parliament yesterday trying to calm things down. Donald Trump is doing the opposite. He's doubling down. He continues to reinforce this issue that Greenland needs to be a part of the United States. So he's going to face off against these world leaders today as he's just getting to the facilities there to talk with some folks.
I'm wondering if there might be more detail into why he wants to take Greenland. I think that has been missing in this whole argument. It's like this blustery, aggressive, they're going to be ours no matter what thing. And people are wondering why now? I learned more reading this 2022 article from Reuters than I have from everything going on right now that, you know, Russia has been opening tens of military bases, modernizing its navy, developing hypersonic missiles that are right near Greenland. So this makes sense that maybe you would want a bigger presence, but you have to explain it.
Yeah.
Well, and again, they have the ability to have a bigger presence there.
There is a treaty that was signed in 1951 that allows
with Denmark
the mm-hmm. Americans yes. to come to Greenland and do things like that. So there's a question there as well. But Arctic experts saying it would take the West 10 years to catch up to Russia's military in the region. So, you know, I get it if you read something like this, but I think there needs to be
you
a
don't
case
think the
made.
Administration has made that case.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how it's going to affect the markets when the markets open right now. They're all sure. down right now. The Dow futures down about 100. S&P 475 and NASDAQ 4750. So they're all down right now. So we'll see. Because yesterday, big sell-off yesterday.
Meanwhile, the second lady, Usha Vance, and J.D. Vance are expecting their fourth child.
Congratulations to them.
Very exciting news.
Yeah.
Exciting stuff for them. I'm happy for them. And, you know, anytime a baby is born, I'm into it.
Governor Whitmer says she believes the U.S. is ready for a female president. That means she's running? I don't know. She's pushing back on former First Lady Michelle Obama's comments suggesting the country still has a lot of growing up to do. Speaking at the auto show, the governor noted that despite Kamala Harris's 2024 loss to Donald Trump, women won multiple statewide races in 24 and 25, including Michigan's new U.S. Senator Alyssa Slotkin and governors in Virginia and New Jersey. She says, for whatever reason, we have not had a woman president yet, but she thinks that we will at some point in the near future. She added that gender was not the deciding factor in Harris's loss, pointing to other dynamics in the 2024 election after President Biden dropped out mid-year. The governor also addressed election security in Michigan, saying her team remains on high alert to ensure the state is prepared for free and fair elections amid concerns about interference from the Trump administration.
So she thinks America's ready?
Yeah.
Great news.
And I think, you know, she wants to make sure America's ready because she's probably going to run at 28.
I think she's running. Yeah. Everybody says she's
she
not.
Says she's not. Well, she says she's not.
Yeah,
but, I, mean,
I don't.
Yeah.
Time will tell.
Exactly.
I wonder if, to your point, if she is running, why not say it?
I think it is a politically fraught environment currently. And I think it's difficult to be a Democrat at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she wants any of that attached to her at the moment.
You think she wants to wait until after the midterms? And so if the Democrats take over the House and the Senate?
I think that would help.
I don't think you can wait that
long. No, not that long. But I think if they're able to...
If it's looking like... If it's looking good.
If they're able to coalesce around a unifying message, which they still have not done.
No.
They're working on it, but they haven't done it yet. And I think that as more work gets done, you know, we're seeing like... Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania trying to refine some of the things that he's talking about. So I just think that they need to Some chips still need to fall.
Because the presidential campaign is usually about a 2-year campaign.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. A little over. But
I think a little more than that these days in this political world. It's like forever. But who's the other state governor over there? Gavin Newsom, who's
Josh Shapiro.
Right.
And Josh Shapiro, too. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, kind of looks like it. Signs are pointing that way. I don't know.
And you're in Davos talking at the World Economic Forum.
Right. Exactly.
Just want to get some FaceTime with some of these world leaders.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just say it's just my reading between the tea leaves.
I'm getting investment. I'm getting them to invest back here in Michigan. That's what I'm doing.
Sure.
Let's talk about sports. The Michigan State Spartans, nice West Coast run here, and they took care of business against the Oregon Ducks. Carson Cooper at 19 points. The Spartans have won 5 straight now. Cohen Carr was great. Kurtang's defense rattled the feathers of Tom Izzo, and the microphones picked him up talking to Kerr. See if you can make this out. He said, Kerr, you can't guard my mother. My mother. And then the reporters asked Tom about that, and he said, well, we're all flying back to East Lansing, and Kerr is flying to Appleton. Check USA Today tomorrow. Him and my mom will be going at it at the nursing home gym.
Oh,
wow.
But he has a relationship with his players that he can say and do things like that.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's not a big deal. And so I love him for
Michigan
that.
Michigan big winners too, right? Yesterday.
Yes, Michigan gets a win yesterday.
And we play them next Friday.
They're coming up on the matchup. Yeah, Michigan got a win against Indiana 86-72, and now they are 17-1.
Really good teams.
Yes.
You know, and the thing with Izzo that I love is he never sugarcoats anything.
Oh.
Ever.
No.
Ever, ever, ever. And in this world of specifically college athletics, it's like refreshing, even though he's never changed.
No, and that's why
everything else has changed around him.
That's why he has the respect of his teams. That's why they respect him. He just tells it like it is.
He tells it like it is, but also, like, some guys need harder coaching. Some guys, you know, you have to change your style depending on a person. Everybody's different. Everybody's got a different, you know, what they respond to. Mm-hmm. So, like, some guys he's harder on than others. Publicly, even in the middle of a game, he really gets into some of these guys. But that's how they respond to it, and it's never hard feelings. There was that, remember that rapport is like, Tom Izzo's yelling at people. He's pretty aggressive. And it's like, yeah, he's a basketball coach.
It is. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And he talks about it a lot. Like, oh, this day and age, can't even say anything.
Right.
Can you please play defense?
Right. We would really like it if you could play defense.
No. The way he said it was, yeah, I'm sure it got through.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, interesting op-ed in the Washington Post admitting the affordability issue may be the first step to solving it. We're talking about it next on JR Morning.
Welcome back to JR Morning. The word affordability is being bounced around a lot by lawmakers now, and the affordability crisis is something that a lot of lawmakers are talking about. There's an op-ed in the Washington Post by Zachary Carabel, who is an author and investor. He has a Substack called The Edgy Optimist, and he says that he takes umbrage with using the term crisis after affordability. Why is that? Let's ask Zachary. He's on the line now. Hello, Zach.
Hello. Good morning.
So you say crisis means a sharp new problem, and this is not a sharp new problem.
That is indeed what I say. And look, you could accuse me of just picking hairs or getting hung up on words, but the point I'm trying to make is if you misdiagnose a problem, right, if you're a doctor and you misdiagnose it, you're going to come up with the wrong set of solutions. So if we view what's going on in terms of affordability as a crisis, right, and a crisis is an acute, sharp, sudden thing, rather than as a chronic problem that has been building with some ebbs and flows, but has been a not just a steady state, but an accumulating steady state for really at least 30 years, maybe even back to the 70s, then you're going to come up with different solutions, if you can come up with solutions.
Zach, is this an argument about reality or about how we're framing the problem?
Again, I think by framing it as there's this affordability crisis, and I guess that began as a crescendo in 2024. It was one of the reasons that Biden and the Democrats struggled so mightily in the 2024 elections, and it's building again, except now it's toward Trump and the Republicans. And the narrative is like, this is because this party, Democrats in 24, Republicans now, have bad policies. And that if we just change the bad policies of the current people who we perceive to be in power, then things would be better. And I'm arguing that that's going to be a misdiagnosis of a much more intense structural problem, whereby there's been much greater wealth accumulation at the top. There's been a challenge of basics like housing and healthcare. Although housing is more complicated, healthcare is unequivocal, right? If you're going to look at any issue we have over the past few decades, the rising, intensifying out-of-pocket cost of healthcare to most American families is unequivocally one of the greatest problems, full stop. Housing is more nuanced. I mean, it kind of depends on where in the country you are. It depends on whether you're renting. It depends on whether you're buying. And there's a lot of conflicting data or different data, depending if you live in New York City or San Francisco versus if you live in Wichita or Louisville. So that's a different matrix.
Well, yeah, and to your point, you reference some Gallup surveys on economic sentiment. You say that the only times in the last 30 years that there was a double-digit percentage of people that thought the economy was excellent and a single-digit percentage of people that thought the economy was poor was from 1998 to 2000 and then in 2019 going into 2020. So is this more of a political talking point? And to your point, if there is a broader systemic problem, how do we address it without making it political and actually helping people?
Yeah, I mean, that is a great question. The political part, and it's really good that you brought that up. One thing that has changed, and it's really over the past 10 to 20 years, is whatever party is out of power, meaning doesn't have the White House, blames the president or the party in power for the economy. So Obama and Biden's terms, Republicans thought the economy was terrible. Democrats thought it was, okay. Trump 1, Trump 2, Republicans think the economy is pretty good. Democrats think it's terrible. And that's a really unfortunate dynamic because, you know, the economy is not partisan. There's no Republican or Democrat economy. And to start phrasing it as such, you know, then we're totally lost in the woods because then it just becomes a, things were fine, but the person or the people I don't like are in power and things are terrible. And that's just not the case. And I try to show, look, it's a 1,000-word editorial. There's only so much you can do. But I tried to show that the levels of discontent have been chronic and intensifying. They are not based on the president. They're not based on the Congress of the moment. You could say they're based on decades of cumulative policies or the failure of policies to do what they are designed. I mean, we have so many laws, particularly from the Great Depression and then Lyndon Johnson's, you know, Great Society, War on Poverty, that are designed to like provide safety nets, provide some baseline economic security. And the net effect of a lot of those has been to not make things much better and sometimes make them worse. And I think if we started from a perspective of we're a vastly affluent country, no one should lack for a meal, a home, a school, or a doctor, and we just kind of went from there, you know, we might find a way to do things, but I'm not, that's the work ahead. But saying it's like things were okay 6 years ago, now they suck, or, you know, everybody looks back at their highest income and their lowest cost and romanticizes their past, that does us absolutely no good in dealing with the fact that if you look at the past, people were not sitting around for most of our lives going, hey, things are great. This is just wonderful. I feel wonderful. I feel so good.
And you end it with, you think our system, our economic system fails some people consistently. So if that just seems like a huge problem, how do you tackle it? That's a question, I guess, for the people in charge.
Yeah. Well, first, I think you name it, you acknowledge it, you take away the Democrat versus Republican as causal. And you start going, okay, what can we agree on doing? And
the United States might have a better shot at taking Greenland than eliminating the Democrat-Republican divide
these days.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, taking Greenland logistically is easy. Taking it strategically is hard. But the doing of it would be simple as opposed to these issues. You're totally right, which are hard. But it's supposed to be hard, right? No society easily finds its own perfect formula, unless it's really homogenous and really small. And we are neither small nor homogenous. So it's going to be a challenge. But all I can do, you know, the best that ideas can do when put on paper or this kind of conversation
is get people talking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And you have done that, Zachary Karabell. Thank you so much. And you are the host of The Edgy Optimist. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Good discussion.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, when was the last time that you're like, man, I have so much money and it's going, some of the dollar is going so far. Things are great. I haven't thought that ever.
I feel like people point back to, I don't know, the 50s when a whole family could live on one income and buy a house. Yeah.
But I also think the expectation.
Yeah, but those people still, I mean, it's still a struggle, right? I mean,
right.
It was, if you weren't like a doctor or somebody like that, you still, you know, you still lived ends meet and paycheck to paycheck.
I think the expectations about what constitutes a good life is changing faster than the economy can deliver.
Mm. What do you think about the affordability crisis? Is it a crisis or is it a problem that's been around for a long time? Let's get into it at 835.
All right, 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. There is an affordability issue. Things are just too darn expensive. They're too expensive.
Yeah.
Who is the dude, Cornell, was it Cornell West
Cornell
out
West.
In New York?
Mm-hmm.
The price of rent is too damn high. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's how people have felt forever, for a very long time. Things are out of whack, though. I mean, the what maybe constituted as a $500,000 home 20 years ago is now over $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's true.
Right, and to Zachary Karabell's point, and if you missed our interview with him, you can go back and listen on WJR.com. This idea of the housing issue being more nuanced is more nuanced. But people have felt forever that their dollar isn't going far enough. And it has become a political issue because what is the saying? It's the economy, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's the economy, stupid. That's where politicians must live. In 2024, the Biden campaign did a terrible job mm-hmm. of relaying that message. The Harris campaign did a terrible job of relaying that message. And instead of coming to the people and saying, hey, look, this is a problem and here's our solutions to it, they dismissed it. Well, Donald Trump leaned into it. And that, among other major issues, immigration being one of them, was the reason that people flocked to him.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, this hasn't changed. People have always felt for many, many years that their all of the fruits of their labor, all their hard work, that in their 9 to 5, their 10 to 10, whatever it is, that it's not going far enough.
Yeah, and we talk about housing prices and how they're skyrocketing, but this stat within the opinion piece I thought was staggering, that home ownership is stable. That in 1990, it was 64%. Last year, it was 65%. And it peaked at 69% in 2004. Lowest point, 63% in 2016. So people are still owning homes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that crisis could be in the renting space right now, but people still have their houses, it seems.
Yeah, but people, you know, are waiting longer times to buy a home, though, right?
Yeah, the average age mm-hmm. of a first-time home buyer is like 40 now.
Yeah.
I mean, 10 years ago, my wife and I I guess 12 years ago or so mm-hmm. now, before my wife and I got married, we had a one-bedroom apartment in Farmington Hills,
mm-hmm.
and I think we were paying $1,200, $1,300 a month.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's astronomical.
Yeah.
And then you ask these kids coming out of college to go, all right, make it, figure it out. Oh, well, you also have to pay your car insurance. You also have to pay your monthly payment on your car. You also have to pay for groceries, your cell phone
lights
bill,
and gas,
everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it becomes unattainable. That's why you see more kids coming home after they graduate college, right, and trying to find something local.
Yeah.
But there is a problem, but that hasn't necessarily changed. It's been that way for a long time, and the point is that there are bigger issues here. We have let the cost of, for example, education skyrocket. No checks and balances on that. These schools raise tuition every year, and it makes it so when you come out and get a job, you don't have enough money to, let alone pay your bills, to pay the amount of money that you owe on your student loans.
Student loans, yeah.
So it's almost as though right out of the gate, when you're supposed to hit the ground running, you can't. It's like you're trying to drive on the lodge right now and your wheels are just slipping. Mm-hmm. You're not gaining any momentum. So it's frustrating. And then that only leads to this idea inside of, well, how am I supposed to get along here? How am I supposed to live? How am I supposed to raise a family? How am I supposed to buy a house? It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, and when you're in it and on your and you're in the hamster wheel, that you really feel it. But to the point of this post in the Washington Post, that this is not a crisis because crisis means sharp new problem. That this is a problem that our economy and the way it's set up, it's just inherent within it.
So now what the, you know, so basically it's up to our politicians to fix it. Are we debating on them or relying on them to fix it?
Are you?
I mean, I think everybody is what you send people to Congress for to fix your problems. And, you know, instead of maybe pulling Maduro out of Venezuela or trying to get Greenland and all of that stuff, the people are still at home saying, I'm having a tough time here. What are we doing for prices here at home?
Well, that's fine. I mean, again, I think this it does transcend politics. It's everybody's to blame. Everybody. Nobody has made things more affordable for people.
Mm-mm.
So what is that? What do you want us to do? Like, what do you want us to believe? We send you there to do a job, to your point, and yeah. You don't do the job. So what are we supposed to believe? It's a problem. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Meanwhile, the president speaking in Davos right now, he is addressing the World Economic Forum, certainly as this issue of Greenland continues to be a main issue. And you know, these meetings that he's supposed to have mm-hmm. with these world leaders, it's what do you want them to do? What is the outcome here? Donald Trump says it is U.S. ownership of Greenland. I don't know if that is necessarily the right approach here.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump often talks about the art of the deal. And so
and he says
is
no
this all
back.
Part of that?
And he says there's no going back.
But then I get stuck on the fact that is it the art of the deal? Because is there a deal even to be made? You can have a military presence
yeah,
on Greenland.
Right.
You can bolster not only the United States' efforts there, but NATO as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But we could do that right now. That could be done right now.
Yeah.
And instead, we're going down a completely different path.
It could be a bargaining, you know, philosophy of his. It's what he does. He goes hard, like, I'm going to take the hardest tact and then backs off the
off.
Taco thing.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's just a way to get these people talking about the idea of Greenland, but you got to make the case about the security of it and what's going on in the Arctic.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump's talking. We're going to monitor that. If he says something important, when he says something important, we'll make sure to bring that to you. We will take a break. Coming up on the other side, we're going to play Name That Tune, and up for grabs today, John Mellencamp tickets. He's going to be here when the weather is a little warmer. He'll be here July 16th. He's coming to Pine Knob. So we'll give you an opportunity to win those tickets as well. It is Name That Tune Wednesday here on JR Morning. It's next.